It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. Today, Nora Ephron reminisces not about her writing and directing stints, but about the other longtime loves of her life, eating and cooking. Nora's new book is I Feel Bad About My Neck and Other Thoughts on Being a Woman. Oh, forget those fussy hors d'oeuvres. Sally Schneider has streamlined them down to easy and still elegant. We get gift picks for the wine geek from a most reliable source, the Wine Spectator's Matt Kramer. That hedonist with a scholarly streak, Fred Plotkin, tours us through the essential Vienna. Then it's the new nanny nutrition dilemma. Is she supposed to be a health expert or a babysitter? And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine.
You know, Lynn, Hanukkah causes us sometimes to ponder our Jewish heritage. And for
dreidel, I made it out of clay.
No. You may think of dreidels. I think of food. For me, Jewish heritage is all about the food. And actually, Lynn, I say this because we recently found a deli, a real Jewish, kosher-style Jewish deli just outside of Washington, D.C., that has great Jewish-style food.
And if you're Jewish, you can say the name of this place with great happiness. It's chutzpah. And I think you need to have that, be born with that guttural glottal stop to get this, it out correctly. Chutzpah.
This is one of those CH words that if you are not born to it, you have a lot of trouble because it's been pronounced, what is it? Chutzpah.
Well,
right,
it smells and like chutzpah.
Do you know what it means?
Well, I think it means nerve, doesn't it? It means, you know, having the gall to do something, having the courage to do something.
A kind of braggadocio, nerve, cojones, if you will, to do a cross-cultural reference. But in fact, the restaurant does have chutzpah. I mean, because in fact, it looks like a little kind of out-of-the-way storefront place in a shopping mall. It doesn't look like much at all, but it has a huge personality. It bills itself as a real New York deli. And in fact, it is.
In fact, chicken in a pot, which is one of the great staples for hot meal serving Jewish delis, is an endangered species. And we ordered chicken in a pot, which comes boiled chicken with kreplach and matzo balls carrots. And Michael took one sip and he said, it tastes just like yours to me. And
I said it tasted like my grandmother's. Drink.
Right. I'm sorry.
But that is a dish that if you don't know what you're doing, it can taste like the devil. And that's home cooking. I mean,
it's real home cooking. And let me tell you, the matzo balls in the matzo ball chicken noodle soup were really tender, full-flavored, and big, like really big, gnarled, hand-formed matzo balls that were delicious.
They also serve hot or cold borscht, which is the beet soup. Do you like that, Lynn?
I love it. I'm just wondering, do they fly any of this out of Virginia and into other places?
Well, a lot of their business is takeout. You know, you can get pounds of whitefish salad. You can get, you know, a couple pounds of sliced pastrami, nice rye bread to put it on.
And very, very in small print on the menu under the pastrami, it's sandwich. It says, please do not embarrass yourself and ask for mayonnaise, which I thought was, you know, quite wonderful.
I like this place. Hey, do they do Kugel? The noodle kugels?
Do they do kugel? They do everything.
The noodle pudding?
Yes, they do great. It's kugel. I love kugel. I love, you know, kugel, it comes in two ways. It's both sweet and savory. I mean, the savory kind has a lot of onions in it. The sweet kind is sort of cinnamony and sugary.
Right. But aren't both served with the meal as opposed to dessert?
Yes, it's a side dish. It's like a noodle pudding side dish. What was really great here in terms of side dishes were the latkes, you know, potato pancakes.
Oh, yeah.
Big ones, which usually make me worried because big potato pancakes can be gummy inside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but these were delicious, and they came appropriately sided with applesauce and sour cream. It's really a wonderful place.
It's funny because our waitress had never tasted Dr. Brown's Celray soda, which I had with a Reuben sandwich.
She was not one of the chosen people.
Obviously.
So we gave her a sip.
What did she think?
She didn't think it was as horrible as she thought it was going to be.
But I don't think she's going to be getting any soon.
No. This is definitely a Dr. Pepper girl.
But this is interesting because how many places do you see that say, you know, New York style deli, and you realize the closest that they ever got to New York, you know, was looking at a Steinberg poster that they, yeah. you know, they don't know right. what a really great deli is like. And this place sounds so good.
And it's the real deal.
Everything. They have matzo bread, blintzes. Even Jewish style wiener schnitzel with lemon wedges on
oh,
it.
Boy.
It's really a wonderful place. Plus the traditional big New York black and white cookie, which you have to have at the end
yes,
of the meal.
Yes, exactly. Hey guys, thank you.
You're welcome, Lynn. Happy Hanukkah.
And Mazel Tov for some.
And to you both too. I'm not going to try to pronounce it. Jane and Michael Stern are authors of Two for the Road. Now, you can hear the Sterns right here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go, you know where, the website, splendidtable.org. Now, I've got an unusual Italian version of that chicken in a pot. I found Maria Bertuzzi's lemon chicken in the hills of the Emilia-Romagna region. This is how it's made. The chicken is browned until it's bronzed and crisped. Then it's cooked with diced vegetables, tomatoes, a little clove, finished with a shot of fresh lemon. And it reheats like a dream. You serve it with rice or polenta. Now, you can find Maria Bertuzzi's lemon chicken on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to register for our weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. Every week we send you a recipe along with tips and the occasional life lesson. So sign up at splendidtable.org. Oh, and one other thing. While you're on the website, be sure to look at our latest travel opportunity. We're hatching a plan to spend some time next summer in the Willamette Valley outside of Portland tasting wine. Now, details are still being worked out, but there's a place to sign up for more information. And again, you know where you're going to find it. Splendidtable.org. In her heart of hearts, cookbook author Sally Schneider is a strategist. Every dish for her is an opportunity to build a new plan, to expand an idea, and to streamline. Now, this time of year, I figure we can use all the streamlining that we can get. Well, Sally's new book fits right in. It's called The Improvisational Cook. Hey, Sally, welcome.
Hi, Lynn.
You know, I want to talk about hors d'oeuvres. This is the season, and as far as I'm concerned, they are a total pain in the neck, and I figure you must have some solutions.
I do, and I have gone through the same terror and anxiety about them as everyone else has, and over the years I've developed some that I'm really proud of because they're really easy and they give a big bang for the buck, like white truffle popcorn, of course. Mm. Now, white truffle popcorn came about when I was thinking about popcorn, which I love, and I thought, why not put another flavorful fat on it instead of the usual melted butter? So one thing led to another, and I thought, here's some white truffle oil. Why don't I just flavor the butter with that and pour it over the popcorn and add some sea salt? It is unbelievable. It's the perfect play of high and low and totally cools out truffle oil, which is too overused.
Oh, that was what I was going to say. I mean, you find it on everything, but this makes sense.
Yes, and it's perfect with drinks. It makes people crazy. The trick is to not overdo the truffle oil. It should just be an undercurrent.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, along the same idea, there's crispy sage and garlic popcorn, which I made by making a frizzling fresh sage leaves with garlic in olive oil till they were crisp and pouring it all over plain popcorn, which you can pop yourself in a hot air popper or even buy already popped.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day I thought, well, what about little onion rings? Why don't I thinly slice some shallots and fry them in peanut oil till they get really crisp and make a shallot-y oil and throw that over the popcorn? So you get the idea.
Three courses of popcorn before the meal has begun. I think this is a great idea.
It is. It is. Moving on, you know, I'm always thinking about classic approaches and then how I can monkey with them. For example, the classic garlic rub toast that we do as a base for bruschetta, that is coarse country bread that I've toasted, brushed with olive oil, and rubbed with a cut clove of garlic, I thought, why don't I rub it with a cut shallot to give it a nice oniony flavor, which is released with the warmth of the bread. Mm. So, and onto which you can put all kinds of things as you would bruschetta, including cheese that you might throw under the broiler, mashed white beans, goat cheese, slow-roasted tomatoes, that sort of thing.
Right.
But then, Lynn, to sort of reduce it even further, I thought, you know, why don't I take the basic idea of a piece of bread that is brushed with oil and rubbed with a cut garlic and shallot, cover it with a layer of pancetta, and put the whole thing on a baking sheet in the oven. And what happens is, in a 375-degree oven, after about 25 minutes, the bread gets crisp on the bottom as though it had been fried, because basically the pancetta fat is sort of basting it. The center is soft, and the pancetta becomes crisp and chewy.
Ooh.
Now, that's really something.
And pancetta looks like rolled bacon. It's the same cut, but it's cured differently. So you get those paper-thin slices. It's not as much fat as you might think.
Exactly. And it's for very little work. I can keep pancetta or bacon, which you can use as well, or guanciale, cured pork cheek, which is available now increasingly, although not completely widely. But you can keep them in the freezer. Wrapped in, I keep it in little packages of two or three slices to pull out at a moment's notice to do with something like this.
And the bread could be in the freezer, too. You could even pre-slice
exactly.
it. Yeah, so you've got it.
Exactly. So you've got everything there, and you know people are coming over for drinks, and you can just whip this up very easily.
Have you got one more idea?
My favorite, I think, is real onion dip. Caramelized onions, just these are sliced onions or shallots, if you like, that have been sautéed in a pan until they're brown and very soft and melting, cooled down and mixed into real sour cream, and you have a real onion dip. And all you have to do is get hold of some great potato chips, which is easy these days.
Right, exactly.
And you're all set. Now, I just want to say one more thing about all of these things. Not only are they great hors d'oeuvres, they are really great when you are home alone, exhausted, and need a treat.
I'm going to stay with the white truffle popcorn. Hey,
okay.
Thank you, Sally.
You're welcome.
Food writer Sally Schneider's latest book is The Improvisational Cook. Now, we've got the recipe for her pancetta tartines on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, Nora Ephron talks life and the American food scene and gifts for wine geeks. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Nora Ephron's screenwriter mother told her, take notes. Everything is copy. And she did. Those notes led to books, movie scripts, then directing in Hollywood and on Broadway, and all the time she cooked. Cookbooks, cooks, meals show up everywhere in her work. Well, her new book is about being 65 years old. It's called I Feel Bad About My Neck and Other Thoughts on Being a Woman. Nora, good to have you back.
It is great to be here. Love this show.
Well, thank you, ma'am. You know, I'm looking at, let's see, food and film writing and directing are coming together, right? I understand there's a new project for you?
Yes, I have. You probably interviewed Julie Pell. I don't know. Julie
Yeah, we
Pell,
did, yes.
Yeah, Julie Pell is a woman who lives in Queens and wrote a book a few years ago about how she navigated a midlife crisis, or not midlife, 30, by deciding to cook every single recipe in the Julia Child cookbook in 1 year and write a blog about it. And I hope I've turned it into a movie script and that we're going to make it. So,
well, now, is Julia Child going to actually appear in the movie?
Yes, in the movie, yes.
Who do you picture playing her?
Well, I'll let you know when the part is cast.
Okay.
But there are a lot of people who could do it. A lot of wonderful actresses who could play Julia.
It's going to really be interesting.
And yet there is probably one who would be better than all of the rest. So I hope I will cast her.
Okay, we'll have to check in with you later on when you're willing to reveal and when it actually becomes fact. You know, there's a very funny line in your book, and it involves Julia. You were in your 20s, you were going out on your own for the first time, and you said, and this is the quote, "Just before I moved to New York, two historic events occurred. The birth control pill was invented, and the first Julia Child cookbook was published." I love that.
Well, those were the two shaping events for the 60s in some, I mean, everyone thinks it's the Beatles or something, but I just think it was the birth control pill and Julia Child, which shows you where I come from. You know, I think it changed the way everybody lived and the way everybody cooked. And you know, you were able to have, you know, sex with someone and then cook for them, which was a perfect combination of things. A fantastic daily double, as they would say at the racetrack. And so, you know, I basically came to New York and bought my bed linens and my Julia Child cookbook and went to work as a journalist and cooked and cooked and cooked my little heart out. You know, I had friends who had these kind of pathetic refrigerators with two yogurts in them, and I was coming home every day and teaching myself to cook. I had the Michael Field cookbook and the Julia Child cookbook and Craig Claiborne's first New York Times cookbook, which is, I still think, one of the greatest cookbooks ever published. And I would be home alone cooking myself a little dinner for three or four.
And eating it all.
And eating it all, yes.
The thing, too, you talk about is you had conversations with these people in your head, didn't you?
Well, you know, they were imaginary. They're imaginary friends. When you really get hooked on a cookbook, and if the cookbook has a voice in any way, you really connect to the person who wrote it, and you spend a lot of time with them. You know, I just was always there thinking about Julia, and was I doing this right, and what would happen if she came to dinner, and am I serving the right thing with it? And Craig Claiborne, of course, was an even huger character because he wrote for the New York Times, and he wrote about restaurants, and he wrote about cooking, and he was changing everything so dramatically. And I thought, well, I might actually meet him, and he might actually come to dinner, and what would I cook for him? And the answer was nothing. I had nothing to cook for him except one of his recipes, because I didn't have any recipes. I was just a kind of scratch cook, you know. I had a few index cards from my mother that she'd sent me with the barbecue sauce recipe on it, which was mostly Heinz ketchup. And I didn't think that was going to really work for me and Craig.
Well, let's scroll up to today. Who's interesting you today? What's your take on food television?
Well, I like watching it. I'm a big one for, well, how should we call this? Should we call it by its new name, narrative? Or should we call it by its old name, story? I like
a story.
I like a story. So I don't think, oh, I've got to put on the Food Network and watch somebody chop something. I'm not a real addict for that. I'd really rather watch something with a plot.
Nora, food writers. Who are you reading?
Food writers?
Yeah, or people who write about food. There's a sort of difference.
Well, there's
there.
A cookbook out now called Sunday Suppers at Luke's. That is my favorite current new cookbook by Suzanne Goyne.
Oh, yeah.
She's a
yeah.
chef in Los Angeles who owns a restaurant called Luke's, Luques. And you know that thing where you have, you know, you buy a bunch of cookbooks and you kind of look at them and then you sort of put them on the shelf. This was one of those cookbooks that you looked at and thought, oh, I got to make that. Oh, I have to make that. I've really got to make that. And I have made all of them. And not all of them, but, you know, four or five spectacular recipes. So that's one of my new favorite cookbooks. I also, when I was in San Francisco on my tour for I Feel Bad About My Neck, the San Francisco Chronicle had the wonderful idea of taking me from one bakery to the next in San Francisco, and that was a total blast. I ate, well, more sugar in a three-hour period than I have ever eaten, except for the time I went to the See's Candy Factory. And I picked up a beautiful cookbook there called Tartine, the Tartine Bakery cookbook, which I think I'm probably never going to cook anything out of because it's too serioso. You know, I'm baking.
But it's a fantasy book. You want to dream in that book.
Well, it's a fantasy book, but fantasy books only last so long if you have very realistic evaluations of your gifts as a baker. I am not a baker, although I am speaking to you right now, Lynn, and at home, only 6 minutes from here, a loaf of bread is rising in my kitchen. Here, what I've discovered about bread is, here I am on this radio show with you, but I'm also baking bread. This is amazing. To look at me, you would not know that I'm also in the bread business at the moment. Have you baked bread in your life?
Oh, I don't even want to tell you how much bread I've baked.
Really?
In my
well, this
life.
Is my second loaf, and I can't get over it. And I'll tell you what I really can't get over is the markup in bread. When you think what bread is, it's just a little flour and some water, and they charge you $3 for it. I mean, I've saved $6 this week just baking this bread, or about $5.80.
Nora, you are now the empowered woman. Hey, thank you.
Thank you for having me on.
Writer and director Nora Ephron is author of I Feel Bad About My Neck and Other Thoughts on Being a Woman. Ah, the wine geek on the list. What do you buy that they're going to really like and that won't reveal just how clueless you're feeling right now? Wine critic Matt Kramer writes for The Wine Spectator, the Oregonian newspaper, and is author of the Making Sense of Wine book series. Now, the short way of saying this is Matt's probably seen every imaginable wine geek gift out there. Matt, welcome.
Nice to be here, Lynn.
Well, let's start with the dark side, Matt. What should be avoided at all costs? I mean that both literally and figuratively.
Well, what should be avoided, of course, is something like a corkscrew. You have to remember that the nature of geeks is that they are obsessive, and they are acquisitive, and they are compulsive. So never buy them a corkscrew. They've already got 12, 15, 20 corkscrews.
Right.
So leave off the corkscrew. No wine totes, you know, those things that you carry around wine. They've already got wine totes.
Okay.
Get them something esoteric. One thing that you can get them is a wine such as the Hungarian sweet wine called Tokaj. It's spelled T-O-K-A-J, by the way, but it is pronounced in Hungarian. I've been there, so I know.
Mm-hmm.
Tokaj. And the story about Tokaj, very, very quickly, is that at one time, Tokaj was the most famous wine in the world.
Really?
It was the wine of kings, the wine of popes. It was the greatest wine in the world for centuries. And in fact, people stole their name. They used to be Tokaj, as it was called in France, and
right,
Tokaj
right.
Friulano in Italy. There was Tokaj in California. It's made, by the way, from an indigenous grape in the Tokaj region called Furmint.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, you could get your geek two kinds of Tokaj. One would be, and this is a modern invention, a dry Tokaj. And it sells, it's nothing. It sells for $12-15. It's really nothing at all. And there are producers like Oremus, O-R-E-M-U-S, or Diznoko, and I'm not even going to try and spell that.
Okay.
But you can walk into really any good wine shop and say, look, I'm looking for a dry Tokaj. Chances are they'll say, oh, yeah, we've got that on the shelf back there, aisle 12. And then the other wine you could get is the classic sweet dessert Tokaj.
Now, this is the
one
I remember.
That would set you back $50-70 a bottle. It all depends. I mean, you can spend a fortune on these things, but
right,
you can
right.
get a very, very good one. There's the Royal Tokaj Company. There's Oremus. There's Diznoko. There are really quite a few of these out on the market right now, and I can guarantee you that whoever your geek recipient is will not have either of these two wines and will love them.
All right. Okay, so Tokaj, the dry Tokaj, which I must say, $12, and also I've never had it, and it sounds great.
It's wonderful. Wonderful wine with food.
Okay. Anything else in wine? Because it's terrifying to buy a bottle of wine for somebody who's into it.
Well, another possibility is, you know, as you know, there has been quite a liberalization of the ability to ship wine from one state to another. Not every
mm-hmm.
state allows it, but
mm-hmm.
at this point, we're looking at a good 20, 25 states that where it's legal now to buy wine from one state and have it shipped to another state. In California, you might buy them a bottle of Mayakamas Chardonnay, the 2003 vintage, I believe, is the current one. Mayakamas is in Napa Valley at the top of Mount Veeder. It's about the 2,200-foot elevation. They make a Chardonnay that can last 20, 25 years. I recently had the 76, and it was fabulously fresh. It's unbelievable. It's a Chardonnay like no other in California. It's not a big, goopy, buttery, oaky thing. They use almost no oak.
Mm-hmm.
The wine is austere. It's more like a Chablis than anything else. And the best part is it's $32.
And well, that's really, not bad when you're talking about
not
a special
bad at all.
Gift.
And you can get Mayakamas quite easily. Contact the winery directly. They're on the web, www.mayakamas.com. And it's quite wonderful to buy wine on the web or over the phone these days. You just pick it up, give them a credit card, and boom, it gets shipped off to your favorite geek. It's quite wonderful.
Well, Matt, I think we've got some really great choices. Thank you, and happy holidays.
Same to you, Lynn.
Matt Kramer is columnist for newspapers and The Wine Spectator. His latest book is Making Sense of Italian Wines. Now, Matt's gift ideas are on the website, splendidtable.org. Cookbook author and historian Fred Plotkin was born to travel. He's never the tourist. He's always the explorer. Fred has a hedonist instinct for the local food and a researcher's antenna for what makes a city tick. Well, he's been hanging out in the old Austro-Hungarian Empire. Hey, Fred, welcome.
Great to be back.
Now, you've been in Vienna. Can you paint a portrait of what that city's about?
It is an imperial city, and every person in the city understands that they are descendants of an empire. So whether that empire gave them a profession, gave them the great music, gave them the splendid architecture that's around them, gave them cuisine, the idea was that the people of the empire, and especially its capital, Vienna, would be in the image of the rulers. And Austria was known as Austria Felix, or Happy Austria. Now, the idea was that everybody lived in contentment. That's obviously not wholly true, because certain minority groups and Jews did not always have it easy at all,
right,
in Vienna.
Right.
We should never forget that, ever, ever. But Vienna has this amazing friction that goes on between the comfortable, the homey, and the modern, the progressive, the sometimes sinister, and when all that mixes together with a big erotic overlay, you get a fascinating city.
You said something to me a long time ago about this is a place where the middle class and all the works of the middle class is glorified. Am I remembering this correctly?
Well, not quite that, but that Empress Maria Theresa, who governed in the 1740s through 80s, believed in creating a bureaucracy where everybody had work, creating schools where people learned professions, with the idea that if they had the sense of belonging to their city, their country, their empire, that they would be happier. So that's what this has passed down. Interestingly, too, because the Austrian Empire extended basically from the Baltic to the Adriatic to the Black Sea to lands all over Central Europe,
right,
and almost to Turkey, you have an amazing mix of ingredients that came in, and languages and cultures. So people in that city can basically, you look in the phone book, and it's like looking in the New York phone book, there are these indecipherable names that are very hard to pronounce, but everybody in Vienna ultimately becomes Viennese.
Hmm.
And they eat the foods of all the empire, the old empire, and many beloved local dishes. The Viennese live in sort of a permanent state of nostalgia. So they love today, but they can easily tear up at hearing a waltz from the 1850s, tasting a dish from the 1890s, admiring decadent art from 1910 at a Klimt exhibition. It's all part of who they are. It's just a fascinating melange, which is also a type of coffee. The coffee in Vienna is amazing. The cake in Vienna is unbeatable. I'm not the world's biggest cake eater, but I confess, every day in Vienna I have coffee and cake. It's that good.
Well, the coffee houses are famous. Where would you have us go for coffee?
For coffee
to take home, too.
Well, I always buy my coffee at a place called Julius or Julius Meinl, M-E-I-N-L. This was sort of a Viennese middle-class supermarket, and it still is in most of the city, but the central store on the Graben in central Vienna has turned into this magnificent emporium of food with one of the best restaurants in Vienna. So I buy my coffee there and I take it home. Down the street from Julius Meinl is Demel, D-E-M-E-L, which remains one of the great pastry shops of the world. It has many rivals in Vienna, but you should go at least once just for the environment and for their version of Sachertorte. There's also the Hotel Zacher in Vienna that produces its Sachertorte, and why not taste it in both and compare? And then why not go to the Café Mozart down the street and taste theirs and then decide which of the three does the best Sachertorte? That's what I do. Every time I go to Vienna, I need convincing again.
Is there a main course you might suggest for us?
Oh, many. Many. You see, the Austrians and the Viennese eat all the time. They have breakfast, a big breakfast. Then they have what's called Gabelfrühstück, which is fork breakfast. That's about 10 o'clock, where they have a little bit of goulash and some wine before lunch at about 12:30.
I see.
And then coffee, cake at 4, and supper, and then schnapps, and so on. And a dish that I would always eat in Vienna is called Tafelspitz. Tafelspitz is like boiled beef with horseradish, but let's not think it's that mundane. There's a restaurant called Plakuta, P-L-A-C-H-U-T-T-A, which is near the wonderful Museum of Applied Arts. And there you get a menu that is a diagram of a cow with 23 different parts of the cow. And you pick three or four. They boil them. They serve them with all kinds of sauces and a wonderful beef broth and dumplings. And it's a heavenly meal.
Wonderful.
Save room for the cake.
Oh, yeah. Light eating. I love it. Oh. I love it. A little balance. Fred, thank you.
Thank you.
Food writer, culinary historian, and self-described pleasure activist Fred Plotkin writes for national publications and is author of the newly updated Italy for the Gourmet Traveler. Well, now, we do have a Vienna coffeehouse recipe on the website. It's from another Vienna fan, Rick Rogers. You can find marble Kugelhoff cake at splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. And at this time of year, with its musings over the past and the future, it seems appropriate to ask this question. Who invented the fortune cookie? We're going to have that answer in a moment for you, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment, and you can get to us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, who invented the fortune cookie? Well, first, you should know probably China has never seen a fortune cookie. It was 1916 in Los Angeles, and a preacher there made the first fortune cookie. Now, granted, the preacher was also a baker, but still, you have to give credit for imagination. He was David Young, an immigrant from Canton, and he spread the proverbial word by stuffing folded cookies with biblical sayings. Well, something must have happened to change his approach to reaching his flock, because he soon opened the Hong Kong Noodle Company. He dropped the biblical sayings, and instead his cookies were stuffed with what were supposedly bits of ancient Chinese wisdom. And they, along with green Jell-O, became the brand of the Chinese-American restaurant for decades. Now, I have to give credit where credit is due. I found this story in a new book by Andrew Smith. It's the Encyclopedia of Junk and Fast Food. It's quite a read.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but just call me.
It's time to open the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. Let's get things going. We have got Allison calling from Longview, Washington. Allison, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Cranberry sorbet.
Oh, that sounds like a great idea, especially right now.
This sounds yummy to me. I had a bag of cranberries left over, so that's what I decided I wanted to make. My family's cranberry sauce uses fresh cranberries and fruit. Mm-hmm. But when I looked online at recipes, several one of the berries cooked, so I wanted to hear what you recommend.
Well, you know, there's two schools of thought on this, but I have to say, you know, a basic sorbet is a sugar syrup with the fruit. Essentially, that's, you know, how you do it.
And yeah, that's how I make my sorbets.
Right. And cranberries can be so tart. That's probably why you're seeing so many recipes that are calling for cooked cranberries. But you know what I would think would be interesting? You know that sort of standard recipe for raw cranberry relish where you grind them in a food processor with orange and a bit of sugar and spices? Mm-hmm. Wouldn't it be interesting to do – if I were you, this is what I would try. Mm-hmm. I'd take that sort of standard recipe, vary it with flavorings that you like, and I would use that as the base. It's already sweetened, so it's like having the cooked cranberries. The pieces are small, so you're going to get, you know, bits and pieces of fresh cranberry. And then I'd use the sugar syrup. I'd use your usual formula, but I would do that first because I think your idea is great. You get a brighter, fresher taste of cranberry if it's not cooked first. You know what it reminds me of in a way?
What?
One of the greatest sorbets I've ever eaten. I had, it sounds so, of course, I went to Paris just to eat the sorbet. But the reality is that it was this green apple sorbet in this restaurant. And I was with someone who knew the chef and had worked in the kitchen. It was incredible. Now, it wasn't silky like most sorbets. It almost had a grainy quality. And he said, do you know what the secret is? And I said, no. He said, they are taking tart green apples and they are coring them, but they're leaving the skin on and all, and they freeze them. And then they puree them with the syrup and they make the sorbet.
I have to do this.
Well, it's the same idea with your cranberries, right?
I hear my food processor calling my name.
You got it, girl. You got it. I mean, I just put the slices on a tray and stick them in the freezer. Piece of foil. And then you can toss them in and you do the food processor thing and then you put them either in. Do you have a sorbet machine or do you do this?
No, I do it the old-fashioned way.
Oh, yeah.
I stir the chunks every hour on the hour.
Oh, yes. Okay.
This is wonderful. I'm excited.
You know what? Can you call and even if you just leave us a message, let us know how it turns out.
I will.
Okay. Hey, thank you and enjoy.
Thank you.
Boy, you know, wouldn't it be nice to give pints of that for Christmas gifts and holiday gifts? I mean, have to have them in a cooler, but I love that idea. Really tart, snappy. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Okay, this next call is coming to us through our discussion group at food.gather.com. Lisa calling from Singapore. Hey, Lisa, this is a long-distance call.
Yes, it is. How are you?
I am very good. What do you want to talk about?
Well, my question is that the other day I was wanting to make this lamb reduction sauce.
Yeah.
So I went to a market here in Singapore, and I bought two kilos, which is 4.5 pounds of lamb bones,
uh-huh,
and put them in the oven and braised them and put them in a pot and boiled them for several hours until I got from, you know, several gallons of water down to a half a cup.
Whoa. Oh, boy.
It was really amazing. It really tasted really, really great.
You've created something that you might call a demi-glace.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's like the essence of this meat.
But the problem was, when I served it, you had to eat it within 5 minutes or else it would turn into this very thick gelatin on your plate.
Right,
so I was wondering
right.
what I could put in there that would make it so that it wasn't quite so thick.
This is what you've done. You have eliminated almost all the moisture that exists in this broth that you made from the lamb. And you've taken it down to the proteins, and they're very gelatinous proteins. And this gives it body. So what you would want to do is perhaps just dilute it a little bit. That's what chefs do. You can use boiled down wine to do that, which would give it one dimension. You could use just some lamb broth that has not been cooked down to that degree. So that'll keep that true, you know, lamb flavor that'll just sing right through. Or you could use water because water will not add another taste to it. But you do not need to dilute it by very much. It's just that you have reduced this to such an essence, you're dealing only with protein. You need a little bit more liquid in there. Of course, there's one other thing you can do along with the liquid. You could stir in a little bit of extremely flavorful fat, like, you know, butter or a little bit of, I don't know if I'd use lamb fat, but I might use a little bit of pork fat or something on that order. That would be another dimension of flavor. That just opens up. Protein and fat works really well in sauces. Not a lot of fat, but just enough. But that's all you need to do. But by the way, are you from Singapore originally?
No, I grew up in Seattle, and we moved here about a year and a half ago. But it's a wonderful place.
That's what I understand. It's one of the places I am very much excited about visiting.
People love food here. It's really amazing.
I understand the street food is enough to make you just want to cry. Is this true? I mean, it's so good, evidently.
Yeah, it's very interesting. There are foodies here.
Oh, gosh. Okay. Well, see if this works, because I think it will work for you.
Okay, great.
Because, you know, you've made the original bouillon cube. No, centuries ago, you know, when people traveled at long distances, they would make broths just as you did. They would boil them down just about to the degree you did, and that they would, at room temperature, be like a very, very firm jelly. You know, it was sort of, what shall we call it, 17th century jigglers, you know? I mean, that was basically, and they would wrap them in a paper or in a clean cloth. They were called pocket soup. And they would pack them away, and then all you needed to do was add water, and you would have a broth, or you could cook meat in it. So essentially, you're continuing a tradition that is many centuries old.
Oh, that's great.
Hey, enjoy. This will work for you.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, take care.
Bye.
You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I have been going through a bit of a puzzle because my knives need sharpening, and I've done the best I can, but they really need professional sharpening. And if you don't have anybody in your area that does professional sharpening, where they really know how to keep your knife in the right condition, I found a source on the web. You have to send the knives away, and they're going to be gone about a week and a half or maybe even 2 weeks. But they're really great. The company is called Holloman Company, and they're in Connecticut, and they have been doing this since 1844. Now, it's Holly Knives, H-O-L-L-E-Y, knives.com. And they will send you a special box and special blade protectors to ship your knives. So you go online, you tell them I have X amount of knives. They ask you what kind. They send you the box, and it has these knife protectors, which you get to keep, which I love because they shield your blades. And you ship it back to them. They have the stickers done and everything, and they will sharpen your knives. And one of the things that I've learned, because I've been fooling around with some Japanese-made knives, is do you know that different knives, different styles, have to be sharpened at a slightly different angle? And they know all of this stuff. So when you get your knives back, what you get is a report on each one of your knives. It's like a diagnosis, and they tell you what they've done, and they tell you in some cases even the angle that it was sharpened at. They caution you because the knives are almost surgically sharp, and they even sent me a picture of one of my blades before and after. So we're going to put it up on the website, hollyknives.com. Send your knives away to be sharpened. You know, for somebody who really cooks, it's kind of a neat gift. Anyway. You can call us at 800-537-5252. We have Jason calling from Edmond, Oklahoma. Jason, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, I would like to talk about German roasted nuts.
German roasted nuts? What is this?
Well, I find them at our state fair. They also are sold at sporting events and games and stuff. They're just really good.
What are they
and
like?
I'd love to be able to make them because it seems like they make them right there on the spot, and they must be fairly easy to make, but I'd just like to find out how to make them myself so I can do that at home.
Okay, so then what are they like, though? Because I've never heard of them.
Well, they have almonds and pecans, just lots of different types of nuts.
Right.
And they're roasted in kind of like I guess it's a combination of sugar. I think there's a little bit of vanilla and cinnamon in there.
Whoa, this sounds delicious. And you mean they're roasted right there in front of you, like in a skillet or something like that?
I think so. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think I've got an easy way for you to do this. You need a big skillet, you know, like a shallow pan.
Uh-huh.
And whatever nuts you really like, whole nuts.
Uh-huh.
And then what you'd want to do, let's say if you have 2 or 3 cups of the nuts and a big skillet, maybe want something like a half a cup of sugar.
Okay.
And you want a bit of oil.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Now, it could be a nut oil, believe it or not. I mean, you could use almond oil or walnut oil if you want to splurge, but it could also be something like canola oil.
Okay.
And what you want to do is you throw the nuts in that pan with the oil and you start getting them warm and hot, and then you sprinkle them with the sugar. Mm-hmm. And by the way, as this goes on, you can add the cinnamon and the vanilla.
Okay.
And the idea is you keep stirring them over maybe medium heat. Do that to begin with, because you're essentially caramelizing sugar. And if you try to do it too fast, you may burn the sugar, and that kind of defeats the purpose because it gets bitter. But toward the end, then you sprinkle them with the cinnamon.
Okay.
And you can sprinkle them with a little bit of vanilla. But the idea would be that you're toasting those nuts and you're coating them with the sugar.
Okay.
And then what you want to do is have a baking sheet or a shallow pan lined with foil that you have oiled. And just spread everything out on that and let it cool. Don't touch the nuts until they're cooled, because you know, they're going to be sticky and very, 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 very hot.
Right.
Now, one trick some people use is they spread out the hot nuts on the foil and they sprinkle it with sugar to give it a crunchy, you know, granular taste.
Mm-hmm.
But that's essentially how you're going to do it.
Okay.
Yeah. Really, really simple to do.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jason. Thanks for calling. Take care.
Bye.
Bye. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. You know, in a time of perilous childhood obesity, children's food allergies, and the food scares, what your children eat when you're not personally feeding them is a real issue. Well, what does this mean for the daycare person or the babysitter or the nanny? Well, we have the founder and CEO of SitterCity.com, a matching service for parents and people who take care of children. Her name is Genevieve Thiers. Genevieve, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Lynn.
So how complicated is this issue of what children are fed these days for sitters?
It has become incredibly complicated. It's interesting because I think 5-10 years ago, it was not a big deal to feed the kids pizza or maybe ice cream sundaes on the job. It was one of those fun things, actually, when the babysitter came over and they could have something, you know,
yeah,
that they wouldn't normally be able to have with mom and dad. But in the last year or so, suddenly food issues have become really, really prevalent on the job for both babysitters and nannies. And I think it's like you said, the rise of childhood allergies, the childhood obesity trend, the recent things like the spinach scare or the E. coli scare that just came, or even just the rise in lifestyle changes like vegan or vegetarian or even raw foods.
Are parents now saying, hey, I want somebody who has a nutritional background?
Well, I haven't heard of that yet, but it's been really interesting. The site that I run has just put up an entire section of a library that is dedicated to tools you need to fill out or worksheets so that parents can prepare food rules for babysitters. And I've been hearing that parents are making lists of ingredients that the kids can or can't have, the childhood allergies the kids have, and calorie counters even. I've heard of feeding logs. I've heard of separate cabinets.
You know, I understand the concern of parents, mm-hmm, but this is a lot of pressure to put on someone who is not necessarily trained to deal with these specific problems.
Right. And I have to tell you, as a former babysitter, I think that in some cases, parents really are going a little bit too far. It's perfectly legitimate to tell the sitter, you know, these are the calories they want the kids to have, or these are the ingredients mm-hmm that they have. But then you hear the nightmare stories, like the parent that flips out because, you know, maybe their sitter happens to be Indian and gives the kids palak paneer or something. I think that sometimes parents will take their own eating preferences too far, and that can extend over into the kids and drive the sitters and nannies that are working for them nuts. So it's a fine line.
The other thing is that children can be picky eaters. There are things they will not eat, and yet
right,
parents want them to eat it.
I think that that's a real problem. There might be that particular scenario where the child just won't eat, and the sitter or nanny will be at their wits' end trying to figure out how to get the kids to eat. And, you know, then the parent comes home, and what do you say? You know, it's a difficult problem.
Yeah, it is. And I'm just thinking, now everybody's got to become a cook, too.
That's kind of how I feel as well. I've got a lot of sitters all of a sudden asking us, you know, how to cook this, or, you know, should they be cooking on the job, or do they open themselves even to any liability? It's really interesting.
That's a very good point.
Yeah.
Well, I guess maybe what we have to look at now is you have a nutritionist that lives in, as well as you have...
Right. You have a permanent live-in nutritionist. It's crazy. I know. You know, some of these concerns are also very legitimate. Childhood allergies are suddenly on the rise. I don't remember kids having lots of allergies when I was little, but all of a sudden, everybody's now allergic to chalk or gluten or peanuts or something. It's crazy.
Yeah. This is not easy. Well, hey, thanks for talking with us.
Oh, thank you so much, Lynn.
You take care.
Bye.
Genevieve Thiers is founder and CEO of SitterCity.com. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Nora Ephron, who said, "What my mother believed about cooking is that if you worked hard and prospered, someone else would do it for you." Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media. Now, everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. You'll find newsletters, podcasts of all stripes available for free. So be sure to check them out. That's splendidtable.org. Our producers are Sally Swift and Jennifer Russell, with intern help from Andrew Schumacher. Our technical wizard is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Have a great week. Be sure to join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.